everyone, and welcome to episode 84 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sapolsky, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. Before we get started today, I just want to let you know that I've opened up registration for a brand new project that I'm super excited about called the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. I'm going to tell you all about it at the end of this episode, so stick around after the interview for all of the details. As children, pretty much all of us are asked what we want to be when we grow up, and I think it's fair to say that rare is the child who says they want to be a medieval historian. Somehow, though, many of us do end up as medieval historians studying the most quirky things to our surprise, and perhaps there's no one more surprised about their career than Dr. John Wyatt Greenlee. John Wyatt is perhaps better known by his alias on Twitter, which is Surprised Eel Historian. As someone who fell into becoming perhaps the leading expert on medieval and early modern eels, he researches and writes about the impact of this amazing fish on everything from economics to mapping and ideas of space to even the way in which eels help to form English identity. Here's everything you've been dying to know about medieval eels, who was eating them, how they were eating them, and why sometimes they were a great way to pay the rent. Well, thank you for joining me to talk about eels today. I'm very excited about this because I know next to nothing about eels, and you know next to everything about eels, so thanks for coming on this show.
It's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. Okay, so I don't usually ask people how they got into their area of scholarship because I feel like that's a question that everybody asks. It's kind of cliche. But in your case, I need to ask, you're studying cartographic history, so maps and geography, and then you ended up being the surprised eel historian. So how did that happen?
Through maps, actually. Yeah, as you said, I am trained as a cartographic and map historian, and it's often how I still think of myself. But for completely unrelated reasons, I was looking at maps of London from the 17th century, curious about mapping around the Great Fire in 1666. And I noticed on a number of these maps of London, there were ships in the Thames labeled eel ships, which was unusual because everything else on those maps that has a label is sort of a big civic monument like the Tower of London or the Globe Theater or a neighborhood, you know, that can't sail away. So, and then you have these ships that can in fact sail away. And I wondered why they had achieved this sort of essentially landmark status on these maps. That seemed like it should be a pretty easy question to answer, and then it wasn't. And the process of trying to answer how the eels got so important that they achieved this landmark status on these maps took me down a very long, or I guess a series of long rabbit holes that sort of saw me looking sort of further and further back and eventually trying to piece together the role of eels in English cultural history from the 8th century onward, basically. In the process of that, I turned myself from a cartographic historian into an eel historian.
So was this kind of your first encounter with eels as something to study? Like, were eels a snack of yours before?
Not at all. And I think that's part of the appeal, right? Like, you sort of, for me, it was. And I think for a lot of people I talk to as well, there's a bit of a fascination with eels because they're not really part of our diet or our culture much anymore. And they're slimy and weird. Yeah. So when I saw these ships, these eel ships, my first thought is, eels, really? Why? And it sparks interest that if they had maybe been, I don't know, herring ships or something like that, I maybe wouldn't have stood out quite so much. But the eels caught my attention, and I have found that they catch other people's attention as well. I had no real previous experience with eels at all. Not at all.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had much experience with eels either. I mean, I do have them on sushi sometimes, and barbecued eels, delicious. But I hadn't actually thought of eels really ever in terms of history before. So what is the place of the eel in English culture? Because you kind of allude to the fact that eels really kind of influence national identity in England. So what's the place of eels?
They're sort of all over the place. I think the best analogy I can come to is that, so medieval and early modern England, I think, had an eel culture in sort of the same way that we would today think about the English as having a tea culture, where they consume it a lot. It's sort of part of some daily rituals. It's a really important part of the culture, but in many respects, a background part of the culture, right? Like, it's sort of always there and always present and influencing a lot of things, but generally not sort of a predominant part of what we would think of as the culture. But there, so that's sort of the best analogy I can think of. The medieval and early modern English just ate a ton of eels. There were, you know, in sort of pre-conquest England, the Saxons were eating more eels than any other freshwater fish combined and than any other marine fish combined. So there's a huge number of eels. It's a really important part of the diet, and that spills over into other aspects of the culture. So there are eels in art and in literature and metaphor and toponyms, so place names and family names, all kinds of places. And that sort of goes away by the end of the 17th century. It's backed off into the background a lot more. They're still eating eels, but they're at that point, the fish sort of stopped showing up in lots of different avenues of cultural production.
Now, this may be an unfair question, but what do you think is the reason for that? Why do you think they declined? Do you think it had to do with globalization and trade and that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's a lot of it, I think. So part of it has to do with, so they're still eating eels, not as many, but they're still eating them after that point. But it has to do partly with the fact a lot of English cultural production over the 16th, 17th century, especially, sort of begins to center around London. And the English in London come to rely pretty heavily on imported Dutch eels to get their sort of eel fix. And there's a period of about 15 years in the middle of the 17th century during the Anglo-Dutch Wars where these eel ships get kicked off the Thames. And so there's a period of about 15 years where the English in London just can't get a whole lot of live eels. And I think that's sort of the break point where at that point they eventually invite the ships back and they come back and they stay there until 1938 selling live eels off the Thames. But it's sort of at that point where the eels stop appearing in plays and literature and art and things, and, or at least they do, but in a really diminished capacity. So I think there's this moment where international tension with the Dutch break a longstanding trade and the English look to other places for food and they come back. But one of the things that happens is prior to that point, everybody eats eels from the king on down, but especially people with means at that point move on. And those are often the people who are driving cultural production, the people paying for it. So you get fewer eels after that, I think. I think that's the reason why. It's the best I can come up with.
Well, that does make a lot of sense. And it wasn't until you mentioned the fact that, you know, you're transporting live eels that I thought about that, where you'd have to transport barrels of live eels. And I think about like how you get that home from the marketplace. I guess it's as fresh as possible if you can get it on the Thames in a barrel full of live eels.
Yeah. So actually those ships aren't selling them in barrels though. They're what are called well boats. So the like where the hull of the boat is basically a ship's basically a floating aquarium. So the hull of the boat is full of water and live eels and has small holes in the side of the ship so you can train the water in and out, right? So that's part of why they park out in the middle of the Thames so they have flow of water through the hull. And then you take a small boat out to the Thames and you sort of fish these live eels up from the hull and weigh them out for you and you take them back home. You can transport eels live in barrels. They can live out of water for a while. And if you could pack them in kind of wet moss, they can live for quite a while. But get smaller numbers that way.
That's crazy. The entire bottom of the boat is just an aquarium full of eels? That's insane.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. They start doing that in the middle of the 15th century sometime. By the 1470s, the Dutch are certainly bringing over live eels that way. They start off doing them in barrels and mostly dead, but they shift as London starts growing and the demand starts growing, they shift these live eels. And no, it's a really fascinating trade. And you can do it with eels because eels can transfer from freshwater, saltwater and back, part of their natural life cycle. And some of them do it on a regular basis, sort of living in estuaries. And so you can put them in these boats in the Netherlands and bring them across the North Sea through saltwater and back into the Thames and freshwater. You can't do that with a lot of other fish because they can't make that kind of transition.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And again, something that I don't think would occur to me normally because, you know, that's just not something that I look into on the day-to-day. But speaking about day-to-day stuff, you were mentioning you could kind of compare eels being part of the culture, like tea is part of the culture and something that is consumed daily. So how often do you think people were consuming eels? Do you think it was a daily thing or kind of a weekly thing?
It is really hard to tell. And some of it's going to vary depending on what time of the year you're in. So eels in the spring, the little baby eels migrate up from the sea, and in the fall, the adult-sized ones migrate down to the sea. And those are, especially the downstream migration in the fall, are the best eels because they're sort of the biggest and the fattest. And so those are the ones that people really prefer. But they're catching sort of the mid-sized eels throughout a lot of the year. It's really hard to tell, though, how often people are eating them. We have, especially sort of more common people, there are records of royal feasts and things where they're ordering really huge numbers of eels. So, 10 and 20 and 30,000 eels at a time for big feasts, which is a lot of fish. And we've got some sort of kitchen receipts from noble households where we can see, they're often eating eel several times a week. But that doesn't give us a real answer about more everyday use for, that's their nobles and kings. And I'm not really sure about peasants so much. I think it's fair to say they're eating a lot of eels, but what that translates into is really hard to say. I think one of the things that suggests that they're eating a lot of eels, besides the remains that we have some of, is the fact that eels show up in metaphor a lot in medieval and early modern England. They have a ton of metaphors, and metaphors only work if sort of they're dealing with something that's alive in the culture. So the fact that they've got a lot of eel metaphors and they sort of use them in a lot of different contexts, good and bad, suggests that there's a lot of eels sort of floating around for those metaphors to work.
Yeah. And I would think that they would probably be eaten at least twice a week, I would think, in a household that was pretty devout, because eels fall under the fish category, right? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. Yeah. So there's a whole bunch of fish days over the course of the year. Lent is sort of the most famous block of them, where you're not supposed to eat meat, you're supposed to eat fish. And the reason you're not supposed to eat meat is because it reminds you of sex. Thomas Aquinas is really explicit about this. It's like, you're not supposed to think about carnal sin and sexual desire during Lent or these sort of other church holidays. And he says that eating the flesh of an animal, so, and here he's talking about a cow or a pig or a goat or something like that, that sort of obviously reproduces sexually, that eating that flesh makes you think about sex. That's bad. But fish, he says, fish don't make you think about sex so much. So fish are okay.
It's a bit of a stretch when we're talking about eels. Yeah.
Well, so eels are even better, though. And Aquinas doesn't talk about eels. But the thing about eels is that medieval people believed that they reproduced asexually, that they had some sort of spontaneous generation. And this is a really old idea. This goes back to Aristotle, who tried to figure out how eels reproduce. But it's hard because they mate in the Sargasso Sea in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, way far away from where we can see. We've never actually still seen them do it. It's still kind of a scientific mystery. And for most of their lives when they're living on land, they're technically juveniles, so they don't have developed reproductive organs. Even today, they're really hard for scientists to find sometimes. Those only develop right at the end of their lives when they're about to migrate back out to sea and to mate and die. But at that point, they stop eating, and so they don't take bait anymore, so they're really hard to catch. Nobody found ovaries in a female eel until the late 1700s, and nobody found testes in a male eel until almost 1900. There's this really long stretch of time where nobody could figure out how eels reproduced. And Aristotle suggested that they sort of sprang up out of the mud. Pliny the Elder thought maybe they sort of rubbed themselves on rocks and the skin that rubbed off grew into new eels. And most medieval people weren't really sure, but they were fairly certain that there was some sort of spontaneous generation. So it's a fish that doesn't have anything to do with sex at all. So they're great for fish days and, you know, Lent and other church holidays. And by the time you get to the high Middle Ages, right, that's like a third of the year. There's a ton of those days. And so, yeah, it would make sense that eels get eaten a lot in those days. But it also makes sense because there were just a huge number of them. Historically, eels have made up as much as up to 50% of the fish biomass in the downstream sections of rivers in Europe and the United States. It's a lot less than that at this point, but that's sort of historical data tells us that. And so just an enormous number of fish. So they're sort of this ever-present animal that fits a particular theological niche for them as well. Sort of ever-present and useful at the same time.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating. And I think you were talking on Twitter at one point about eel rents being paid, especially to monastic communities, as a way to just pay your rent, because monastic communities needed a lot more eels and fish than they would quadrupeds, right?
Yes, especially for those days. So eel rents, where you pay your rent using eels. In the earlier medieval period, when there's less hard currency, a lot of eel rents being paid, and not just to monastic communities, but to other landlords, secular landlords as well. By the end of the 11th century, there's about a little more than 500,000 eels being paid in rent every year that I can prove, that I have records of. And we know that that's not exhaustive, right? Because the Domesday Book, sections of England, it just doesn't cover, and it's not as exhaustive as we might like it to be. So at least 500,000, and almost certainly more. And that's a lot. And as currency becomes more available, some of those rents, especially the secular ones, transfer over to being paid in coin. But a lot of the monastic ones hang on, specifically because, you know, monks have a sort of professional obligation to pay attention to fish days in ways that secular landlords maybe don't so much. So yeah, they need quite a lot of eels, especially the big Finland monasteries, Ramsey and Ely and Peterborough and a couple other ones, just have huge numbers of rents coming in, you know, 60,000 rents at a time, or 60,000 eels at a time, excuse me, from some of these villages. And these are being paid not in live eels. These are being paid in eels that have been caught in the fall and then salted and smoked and preserved. And then most of the time they're being paid just prior to Lent, right at the start of Lent. So the monasteries are sort of collecting a cache of food that they can eat during the next, you know, 40 days during Lent. And then they'll keep for most of the year, for at least a big part of the year anyway. So they're sort of stocking themselves up for their religious holidays.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when you were saying that they're at their best in the fall. I was thinking you'd have to salt them or smoke them to keep them for Lent because mm-hmm. you need them for 40 days. Oof, that would be a lot. That would be a lot of salted and smoked eels over 40 days. Now, there was actually a king that died of a surfeit of eels, or they say that he did. Which king was that? Was that John?
No, Henry the First.
Henry the First. I just think that's a great story.
Henry the First. It often gets translated as lamprey, the surfeit of lamprey. As an eel historian, I'll fight for eels on this. But it's really ambiguous. The chronicler, Henry of Huntington's chronicle, uses the word, the Latin word murena, which is a complicated word because it can mean freshwater eel like we're talking about, or it can mean lamprey, or it can mean moray eel, a marine eel. And it gets used interchangeably, often in the same text or sometimes in the same passage. And so it gets really difficult to tell what the chronicler means. But I like to go with eel because it's as legitimate a translation as any other. Yeah, so it's just a short little passage talking about the death of Henry. It says that Henry really liked to eat eel meat. And his physicians told him he shouldn't because it disagreed with him. It gave him indigestion. But he, as kings will do, he did what he wanted and he paid the price for it. So he had one big last meal of eels and then perished. There's a story that King Stephen's son Eustace choked on a plate of eels. But as far as I can tell, that's a 20th century invention. I can't find any sort of sources going back any earlier than about 1920 for that. But it's one of those things that sometimes gets sort of circulated around in enough text that it then becomes sort of canon.
Yeah.
But yeah, Henry the First is the big one though.
Yeah. I like that idea of he just had too many eels, you know, because that's very visual. You can see him at his feast table being like, I just need one more. I just want
just one more.
Yeah. What a disaster it was that he ate that last eel, right, in English history. Yep. Okay, so you were talking about there's different types of eels. Is there a reason, like, one that would be preferred over another, or people just kind of liked all different kinds of eels, freshwater, saltwater, all of them?
Right. So there are a bunch of different kinds of eels. Most of the ones I'm talking about here are freshwater eels. So they're eels that they're born in the Sargasso Sea and they migrate to these ones that I'm studying come to England. They go to England and they come upstream and they live for 10 to 20 years most of the time, although they can live a lot longer than that, in a pond or a lake or somewhere. And then they go back at the sea to breed and die. So those are sort of freshwater eels. Lampreys are different fish altogether. They're a slightly more primitive fish. So they don't have jaws. They're a jawless fish. And they sort of do the opposite of what eels do. Lampreys are born freshwater and they go down to the ocean and spend most of their lives there. So they're the opposite. But people eat lampreys as well. They don't eat them as much, as far as I can tell, and they don't show up in sort of cultural productions like eels do, so I don't think they're quite as important, but they do eat lampreys. There are a couple of different marine eels that get eaten. In the Mediterranean, they'll eat moray eels, which are the kind of eels you'd see in like Little Mermaid, right? Flotsam and Jetsam are moray eels.
Yeah.
But those are slightly more tropical, and they don't swim in English waters, so the English don't eat those. But there's a marine eel called the conger eel, which is really the biggest eel on Earth. Oh, some of them are, you know, 6 or 7 feet long and several hundred pounds. Just enormous fish. And they do eat, but again, not as often. The freshwater eels are the ones that they really prefer. And it's the adults, so the ones that are, they're called silver eels when they're migrating back down to the sea, are the preferred ones because they're the biggest and sort of the most developed. And as I said, the accumulated the most fat because they stop eating, as I said. So they, for their most of their trip back to the Sargasso Sea, they sort of self-cannibalize their fat and their internal organs. Those are sort of the preferred ones. But the yellow eels, which is their stage they spend most of their lives in, the sort of juvenile stage, are eaten as well a lot too. So those are they get caught at mills and weirs and people will fish them with lines and spears and things. So not as preferred, but they'll still take them.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. How do you catch them? Now, I remember that there are fish traps in the Magna Carta. So I was wondering if you catch them by trap. So you're saying that you bait them and you can catch them by line or by spear. So how are people mostly catching their eels at this time?
So there's a bunch of different ways you can catch them. I think probably the most common is traps. You set a wicker trap or a net or a flight net, basically it funnels the eel into a relatively enclosed space or a trap that it can swim into, but has a hard time swimming back out of. And those are still in use, actually, by eel fishermen. Yeah, so they do show up in the Magna Carta. That's another interesting word. The word in the Magna Carta is, I think, Kedeli, and nobody really knows what that means because it doesn't show up much anywhere else. And so they take it to mean fish traps and eel traps. But those are most likely these sort of pike nets and wicker traps where you're funneling the eel into places it can't get back out of. But you can fish them through a bunch of other ways, too. You can line fish them. You can fish them with spears, which you sort of have to do in the winter because eels hibernate. And so in the winter, they sort of burrow down in the mud. And so you sort of have to spear them out of the mud. One of the ways that people catch eels is by setting traps at sort of narrow places in the river and getting a bunch of people and stomping through the river upstream to sort of drive the eels down towards the trap. There's a little mention of that in Chaucer's House of Fame right at the end. He's talking about people chasing around the House of Rumor after new and interesting stories, like sort of stomping like men do after eels. That's what he's talking about there. So mostly you're catching, like, the big numbers of eels are probably mostly being caught through passive means where you're setting a trap. They get caught at mills a lot, actually, because they get, you know, mills have the dams sort of bottleneck the eels, and the overshoots are often places where the eels sort of slide over the edge, and so you can set a trap right there by the overshoot and just catch a lot of eels. A lot of the eel rents set in Doomsday Book are charged to mills and millers almost as often, I think, as they are to fishermen. So mills are a place where eels really get caught a lot. In fact, the very last eel rent I have an example of is from the 17th century, and it's a mill in Norfolk, I think. And the only reason I have a mention of it is because the family who owned it had a really hard time getting the rent out of the miller. He didn't want to pay them the eel rent, probably because he was about the only person left in the country still doing it.
Yeah, well, it's very specific, a very specific rent, but it's one that I think, as you were saying, it's much more manageable for someone like a peasant to come up with enough eels to pay their rent than it is to come up with enough coins to pay their rent. I was going to say there's one important question I haven't asked you, which is, how were people eating them? Like, how were they preparing them? Do you know some eel recipes? Were they barbecuing them, putting them on a spit? How were they eating their eels?
A lot of different ways. Some very basic, where you're, I think, just sort of throwing the eel in a pan with some garlic or something like that. There are recipes for roasted eels where you're spitting them, sort of filleting them and cutting them bits and spitting them. There's eel pies are really common. The preserved eel, the smoked eel, they're not smoked in the way that we're used to hot smoked eels, if you eat any smoked eel, which is a really sort of smoky, flavorful fish. But medieval people used the cold smoking process that took a really long time. And it doesn't cook the eel, it just hardens it. And you wind up with a meat that's really hard and not particularly tasty, kind of bitter. And so for those, most of the time, I think they'd be boiled and then put into a stew or something like that. There are also some really fancy ways of cooking eel. There's a French recipe that doesn't make it to England very often, apparently, called the reversed eel, where you take your eel and you fillet it. So you take the spine out and then you turn it inside out and you fill it with all kinds of things, breadcrumbs and other meats and fruits and lots of spices, because medieval people love their spices. And then you sew it back up and you cook the whole thing in red wine. And so that's a much more sort of complicated way of cooking eel. So the recipes sort of run the gamut. They're from very simple to sort of overly done, I think. But I think for the most part, people are eating them cooked fairly basically. From the early modern period onward, a lot of the eels that brought into London are sold as, the heavy majority of them are sold as street food, where they're being sold, a lot of them out of carts, and basically sort of cut up and cooked and served in hot butter. And you sort of sit there and eat it from your bowl, give the bowl back, and off you go. A lot of different ways to eat eels.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was wondering, is if they were kind of street food, because I don't think everybody really thinks about street food that often when they think about the Middle Ages, but street food was a pretty popular thing and takeout and stuff like that. So eels were a street food as well. That's pretty cool. Because I was thinking about, you could probably prepare them in a way that was easier to carry around. But if you could just borrow a bowl and give it back, that's useful too.
Yeah. And there are also people sort of wandering around selling eels. There's a fellow in the 13th century whose name is escaping me right now, who was murdered for littering eel skins in front of a shop. But he was basically, he was wandering through the streets with a bucket of live eels and selling them and then skinning them on the spot and sort of giving you your eel. Eel goes bad really quickly. And so once you've killed it, you need to eat it pretty much immediately, especially if you don't have any refrigeration. And so, you know, so there's people like him wandering around just selling you an eel. And then there's vendors cooking them and selling them as well. So yeah, no, they're really one of the more important street foods. And for a long time, up through the 19th century, Mayhew's study of London in the 19th century lists eels as the second most consumed street food in London after dog.
So that was not where
second,
I thought that
second
sentence.
Only to dog.
That's not where I thought the sentence was going.
No. No, it surprised me too when I read it, but that's what he tells us.
Yeah, you got to read that one twice. No, I guess what I was thinking of is, you know, just an eel on a stick. pretty handy way of eating it. But, you know, I'm sure it was a lot more sophisticated. But that brings me to my next question, which was, so you're saying that someone got in trouble for discarding eel skins on the street. And medieval people were not allowed to just litter on the street, just by the way, to the people who are listening. You had to be a neat neighbor. You know, I think that, again, that's something that maybe people don't think about all the time. But I wanted to ask you, is there anything else that eels were useful for besides eating? Like, was the skin useful for anything? Do they use them in multiple ways, or was it mostly just eating?
No, that's a great question. And yeah, you're right. You can't just sort of litter in medieval London. This fellow got beat up and killed is because if there's litter outside of your shop, you get fined by the city. And so the shopkeeper's apprentices came out and beat him up because he was about to cost their masters a pretty penny. But there are lots of uses for eel skin, actually. It's a really strong leather. At this point, if you buy something that's eel skin, it's probably not actually the skin of an eel. It's probably hagfish skin, I think, which is fairly strong. But eel skin is awfully strong and was used strong enough to be used in industrial lacing and belting up through the early part of the 20th century. It has a particular advantage in that when it fails, it splits lengthwise and not across. And so even if your belt splits, it's not going to split and break catastrophically. It's hard, though, to make anything out of eel skin other than belts and lacing because it's thin. You can sort of sew a blot of them together into something, but that takes a lot of work and most people don't bother. There are uses for eel skin. They're an ingredient that shows up in a lot of cures and in medicines. Ground up eel skin is useful for all kinds of things. And then there's a lot of remedies that call for you to place the skin of an eel on your body in one place or another. If you've got cramps in your legs, eel skin garters are a fairly common suggestion, things like that. So there are uses for eel skin. The problem, I think, is that they are eating so many eels, they have way more skin than they know what to do with. And the expression, calling someone a merchant of eel skin, meant it was somebody who was a fake and a fraud, somebody who was selling, basically trying to sell you the eel without the meat. So being a merchant of eel skin meant you were suggest that the skin itself was actually not really worth that much. So there are things you can do with it, but I think they probably got a bit overwhelmed with the number that they had.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But I mean, if you're using it for laces, there's lots of uses for laces. So I'm sure that, you know, you could probably make a fairly decent living if you were one of the only people in town who was making eel skin laces. But would you tan that the way you
probably?
Yeah. Would you tan that the way you tan regular leather, or is it like a special way to do it? This may be beyond your wheelhouse, by the way. You can tell me if it is.
That is, you know, somebody asked me that question the other day, like a couple of weeks ago, I think, and on Twitter, and I don't know the answer to it. It's a fascinating question and something that I now want to learn, but I don't know. I can tell you, though, as a sort of another use for eel skin that I find really enjoyable is in the fens, traditionally, wedding bands were often made of twisted eel skin rather than gold. Part of that has to do with there's not a lot of metal lying around in the fens and certainly not much gold, but lots and lots of eels. So eel skin leather wedding bands were fairly common until the late 19th century, early 20th century.
That's really fascinating. And that really kind of speaks to how durable it is, because you wouldn't want to give someone a wedding ring that could just fall off, right?
Just fall apart. No. That doesn't say good things about your commitment.
Yeah, exactly. All right. So before we go, can you tell me what is the weirdest instance of eel history you've come across in studying eels for all these years? What's the weirdest thing you've come across in studying eels?
Oh, that's a great question. There's a bunch of things. Okay, so I think this isn't weird in sort of the classical sense of being strange, but is fascinating to me nonetheless. This is an aspect of history I knew absolutely nothing about, never heard of. This sort of eel history is a bit of the medieval that lasted all the way up into the modern era. So these eel ships on the Thames, I think I mentioned this, they stay there until 1938 is when the last one leaves. And the ships in the 1930s look almost exactly like the ships did in the 17th century and probably very much like the ships did in the 15th century when they started bringing them over. You know, in 1938, they've got a motor in the back, but that's about the only difference. And I'm fascinated by these moments where medieval history sort of pops up in the modern era in some really in interesting ways. And this is one of those places where these ships sort of hung on with this tradition of bringing over live eels and selling them in pretty much exactly the same way that they did 400 years before. And there's film of it. There's a Charles Path did a black and white film of it. And so you can see this. And obviously there's going to be some differences, but it's really easy to look at that film and realize that you're looking at a tradition and a way of dealing with this animal and selling it and marketing it that is, you know, goes back to the 1470s at least. And that's just a really fascinating to me that those places where the medieval world intrudes onto our own.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely agree with you because I think that human nature doesn't change that much over time. And it's nice to see these little bits of history that are continuous and that maybe you didn't even realize were as old as they are. So yeah, I totally agree with you. That's a really cool instance. And I wouldn't have realized it was on film too. So that's great.
No, you can find it on YouTube. Just search for Charles Path and eels and there you go.
Well, that is one more thing that I did not know before today. So I want to thank you so much for coming on the podcast and telling us all about eels. Thank you.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks.
To find out more about John Wyatt's work, you can follow him on Twitter at GreenLeeJW. That's GreenLeeJW. Or you can just search for Surprised Eel Historian. You can also learn more by visiting his website at historiacartarum.org. That's HistoriaCartarum.org.
Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What is new, Peter?
Well, yesterday I spent a few hours watching and even bidding at an online auction.
Oh, yeah? What was it?
Oh, it's like Auction of England. It was like a historical memorabilia. And the reason I went there was that we did a little news report about this coin of Harold Godwinson that was going to go up for auction. It wound up selling for £4,000.
Wow. So that's a little bit over your budget, right?
It was. But there was all sorts of like little things and, you know, medieval coins, medieval bits of, you know, bits of metal and stuff like that. And some of them were, you know, fairly good price, like, you know, 10 to 20 or 30 pounds. And I like, okay, I'm going to go in and I tried bidding like those smaller ones and like, oh, there was always someone else that like wanted to, you know, 3 pounds more, which is like, oh, so I missed out.
Yeah, it's different when you're using the Canadian dollar, right? Yeah.
So, but that was exciting to watch. So, and it's good to see that people are really interested in historical items that they wind up wanting to get at them. So I was watching that. But meanwhile, on the site this week, we have Lucy Lemonnier. She's writing about how medieval people got their sugar fix. So it's all about farming of sugar in the Middle Ages and, you know, what they did with it. So we have that. We have news on how the plagues spread faster in London after the Black Death. And we also have details about the theft of a 10th century saint's relics from a church in Germany. So that happened yesterday. So we have a bit of news on that. And hopefully we'll be getting you updates throughout the week on that one.
Wow, that's not cool.
Yeah, I know. So yeah, they broke in the middle of the day too, and you know it's apparently it's his feast day coming up on October 31st. So let's all pray to him, see if we can pray to him to get his relics back.
Yeah, hopefully he gets his relics back by Halloween. That's good. All right, well thanks, Peter.
All right, thanks.
As I promised, it's time to tell you about my new baby, the Medieval Masterclass for Creators. It's a 6-week online course that I've developed for people who are creating fictional worlds based in or on the medieval world and who need some visual and audible content to help them describe the medieval world in more detail. So novelists, graphic novelists, game designers, television and movie writers, and anyone else who needs some more 3D research. I've enlisted the help of some really amazing experts to teach alongside me, including Ken Monshine, our swordmaster, Beth Rogers, our food historian, Katrin Kanya, our textile archaeologist, and Tom Timbrell, our blacksmith. They'll be showing you the basics of fighting, feasting, making clothing, and making metal. And because you get to watch them do it, you'll get the benefit of their expertise, as well as being able to see and describe or draw their movements. You'll also get access to me for questions about your project, and you'll get an exclusive bibliography for further research. As you can see, I'm really excited about being able to teach and help people broadly, and I cannot wait for you to meet my expert friends. Registration is open now, and class starts on November 13th. But I only have a few spots left after announcing this to my mailing list and on my social media, so you'll need to act pretty fast if you want a seat in the pilot course. If you don't get in, have no fear, I'll be running this course again in January. You can find out all the details at medievalmasterclass.thinkific.com. That's medievalmasterclass.thinkific.com. And hey, maybe you want to think about getting on my mailing list or following me on social media. Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for your support. If you love the medieval world, visit our Patreon page to find everything from subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, to our book club, to our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. You can find all the action at patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from stolen saints to spooky stories, follow medievalists.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sapolsky, on social media at 5minmedievalist or 5-Minute Medievalist. And you can find my books, including Life in Medieval Europe, Fact and Fiction, at your favorite online bookstores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an amazing day.